All right, guys, thank you for listening to the Bomb Pod. Fresh new episode coming out today. First Zoom episode for sure that we've done. Here with my homie, my longtime friend and confidant, Retro.
Day one.
How you doing, dude?
I'm great, man. It's great to be on the show, man. I've always wanted to since like episode one and just never got around to it. So
we
have something to say now.
That's good. We've had mutual friends on here before, so we're just growing everything along, man. So how you been? How's 2020 treating you?
Not bad, man. Not bad. I was listening to the podcast you had with Alex, and I feel like a lot of people kind of resonated with that one, you know?
Just, it did.
Being uninspired at times, you know, through all this.
Yeah, man. It's definitely gotten great feedback. It's my highest listened one yet. That one eclipsed my last one, so that it makes it's good energy. But the amount of honesty I've been getting from the people I've been speaking with as of late has really been very apparent about this tough time.
Yeah, man. So just with 2020, at first it was kind of like I just wish I had more things in the tank, like as far as like video stuff just in the tank that I could really kind of play with, because I felt like it was hard to write and do other things creatively. But as far as like video stuff, I was like, man, if I had a bunch of stuff that I needed to edit, this is like perfect editing flow, you know, where you're just kind of locked in the house and you just need to edit. I guess it would be equivalent to a recording engineer, you know, like if somebody had somebody in the crew that they just had like 60 songs for the crew, you know, and they just haven't gotten, you know, mixed yet. This is the perfect time to mix. Like there's no excuse for mixers or video editors, because you can just kind of lock in and it's more of a logistical thing, like more logistics than it is like impromptu or having to think about something creatively. It's just
now,
like managing the workflow.
For the people who are not aware, what exactly do you do? Because you said you rattle on a couple creative things you do, but I'm sure the people don't know. Like, what would you title yourself? What would your slashes be?
Dang, that's deep. That's deep, man. I think I'm still working on that. I think my biggest. Something that's been interesting about me is I kind of have different hats. You know, I've been playing around with different things. I'm still working on it, man. I'm still working on that title. But I'd say in 26, I had a bucket list. At age 26, I had a bucket list. And I put make a documentary, write a memoir, write a novel, make an album, and get a six pack. Those are my five, man.
Yeah.
My five. And it was just one of those things, like, you know, before you die, kind of what you want to do. So
yeah,
I guess based on what's on that, you know, I'd say, I don't know. I feel like I'm the like opposite of a gatekeeper, you know, like I'm the one that's kind of, I know what it's like to be on the audience side and what it's like to be on the creative side.
Yeah.
I feel like my goal is to kind of break the mold of both of those, you know, and that's definitely something I wanted to talk about. I feel like it's cliche, but once I kind of polished my mission statement, like things that I kind of want to leave behind in the world, it was easier to carry on with action versus having to worry about a job title. Or like what I see myself as, you know, I think I would have to maybe look at it as like, how do others see me?
Yeah.
I think others see me as somebody who's very creative, very resourceful, and is forward thinking, like somebody that kind of knows where we're going in the next 5 to 10 years. And I think I'm just kind of like the 40 Shabib in the room, you know, or like the Kanye, like, you know, where I can kind of mix and mingle these different things and make things happen or bring a spark, you know, for things that people may not see.
Now, I do remember you being heavy into rapping, and you're part of the reason that I got the confidence to start making videos on my own once I kind of understood some actual arts or classic styles of filming. Would elaborate more on at least one of them, because I've always known that anything you stuck to, you tend to be successful at, from even when you're athletic and back in the day, to the how you shifted to creative stuff, to even, you know, success, you know, through university. So obviously everything you touch, there's a method to it. But what was the first passion, the first love that really got you into it?
Okay, cool. So I've always been into sports, but when I was younger, some of the things I used to do creatively first was storytelling. I used to really like writing fiction. A lot of people don't know that. And then I gravitated towards like poetry, and then I kind of got into music, to rap. You know, I just felt like I could really see colors when I was listening to music. And even just being around you and some of the guys, like, I branched out into other genres. But it's funny you mention that, because I feel like I've been a rapper my whole life, but at some point, you know, and this is something I wanted to talk about, but at some point when I turned 26, I had about 2K on me that was kind of disposable. Like, I had like maybe 5 or 6K saved, but I had about 2K that was just kind of like, I wanted to flip or use for something creatively. And I had a choice. It was to get a mic, to get your, you know, your typical 1K or 2K mic setup, or jump into the film game. And when I was in college, a little bit before that, I was really into storytelling. I really liked to read features. Every time an artist would drop, no genre, didn't matter any genre, I would go out, I'll buy the Fader magazine or buy the GQ. You know, I have a bunch of magazines, and I'd read it. And I just love these feature stories, just figuring out where the artist's head was at while they were making this. You know, one of my favorites is Some Kind of Blue, the one they did for Drake when he went back to Toronto, when he was making Take Care. So I've always been big into features and just getting the untold story. And in college, I majored in broadcast journalism. So I always felt that was supposed to be my career path. And I always felt I was supposed to have multiple career paths. Like, there was going to be one that was going to get me in the door.
Yeah.
And the other one was going to help a little as well. And I'd say the first step of like being an entrepreneur or just like getting to where you want to be is taking that risk, you know? And even like now, I got some music equipment, but I'd say when you get like 2K, like 1800 to like 2K, it'll be, the first step is like just taking that risk, right? And I feel like a lot of times people talk about like failures make you who you are, but I feel like a little deeper than that, it's taking risk, you know? Like the capitalistic dream, anybody, it's taking that risk. You know, like betting on yourself. And I feel like failure gets more of the love, but it's really the risk, because you can do something without failing and learning. You know, like back in the day when there was rappers, you know, if you went to DJ Premier, if you went to some big studios, you have to memorize all your stuff. And then on top of that, you have to pay for recording. You might be paying like $80 an hour, $100 an hour, might not even be mixing, right? So just for one single, you might be paying anywhere from like $250 to $500, unless you really know somebody. So it wasn't really people failing as rappers. It was people taking risk, you know?
Yeah.
So I was 26. You know, in my head, I'm thinking, you know, Jay-Z already made it at this point. And then I'm like, all right, if I take this risk, which one of my talents would I be able to cultivate now and really love? And it was film. It was film, you know? Out of all the things I could do, I could write, you know, videography, photography skills, could wrap my butt off. Something just, my energy, you know, where are you spending your time? It was film. So I jumped into the film game first, and that's why I had 2K, my first risk. my risk reward. I was like, hey, I could flip the camera game, I could make some money, and I could build a portfolio. And I always felt counted out when I was in news, because they weren't really giving me creative outlets. It was more so just like kind of like internship, kind of like entry level stuff that I couldn't build a portfolio off of. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to build a portfolio.
Mm-hmm. It's so crazy that through our creative journeys that we go through, just changing our medium, because some of them, you know, quite honestly, are more of a young man's game. Like even you think of like rock star stuff, and you're like, that's something you want to do in your 20s, but you still have like Kiss performing in their 70s. So
yeah,
it's weird how that longevity works. But I understand, just being a director is so much more interesting. You get to be entitled to the entire picture. What did you figure out when you wanted to do that you wanted to shoot? Did you want to compose? Like, what did you want to see as one of your products?
Good question. So at this point, I had a little bit of things that I was really good at. Like, I knew I could shoot a music video. I knew I could do a few things. But what they tell you to do whenever you take a risk, whenever you do something, right? They say, do what you know first. So just going off of that, I was trying to go out with something that I had an in, something that was longer, because I knew that I could do something shorter at some point. So I know hip hop. I know hip hop like the back of my hand. And I had a buddy, his name is Drops. And he was big in the battle rap culture. And I knew that there was a niche that nobody had really done a cinematic documentary on the battle rap culture. And I had an in, and it was bubbling. Like, it was hot to the culture, but it was still an early adopter culture where not a lot of people knew the ins and outs. So 26, I grabbed my camera in March, my equipment, basic necessities from B&H, tax-free, shipping free. And I was on, bro. I had a couple things I wanted to do, but I knew the first thing was going to be a hip hop documentary, some kind of ode to hip hop and my respected crew. And then October came, I hit up Drops, went to the Starbucks on Kendall Drive, cause he was around there. Hadn't seen him in a minute. And I was like, yo, Drops, I want to do this documentary. I want to make it big. I know you haven't really seen what I could do with the camera game, but you know, you just got to trust me. I went to school for this, and I want to do a documentary on battle rap. So that's what I did. I went with, what do I know? And that's what I knew. I knew hip hop.
What is the process of, I mean, you're doing this basically on the confidence of yourself, right? You've not put together a project like this, but you do have background education, and but you're also entering into a world where you're trying to document stuff that's live. And I like battle rap, so I know it's an intense thing. It's not a passive thing, and and it could erupt at any moment. And like, you know, filming the right this and someone receiving it poorly could make the shot of everything. So what plan did you go into doing this? Or did you just kind of just wing it and then put something together based on the footage?
That's a good question. So before I get into anything, I find source material. So around this time, I had already had a lot of source material before I even purchased the camera, right? But the source material that I started leaning towards, Vimeo is a big independent film making community. So I was on Vimeo for a little bit, and there was this person that caught my eye. His name's Sean Dunn. His style has pioneered a lot of the indie culture, and a lot of people don't know that. So Sean Dunn, he has this, this short, it's called American Juggalo 2. Where he gets deep into the American Juggalo scene, but it's very cinematic. So one of his leading subject, I believe he met from the American Juggalo 1 short that he did. It's a documentary. But Sean's style is very amazing. It hits like a movie, but it's rooted in reality. That's what I like with documentaries. It's very cinematic. And what I liked most is that his documentary wasn't about rap it wasn't really about the music culture. It was how there's these subcultures, right? There's these social models that bring people together, and sometimes they're misunderstood as being rebellious or being something that should be shunned, but in actuality, it's something that gets people through their day. And his leading subject was a paraplegic. He was in a wheelchair because he tried to kill himself at a railroad track. And he was just talking about the ups and downs that come with that. But what I liked most is that Sean used these interludes with an artist rapping with the lead. The lead was an aspiring like rapper. He did in his you know, free time. And he was rapping a lot. And you're getting these like surreal moments of like this guy's life, and you're just a fly on the wall. Like Sean's really a pioneer, like fly on the wall,
yeah,
documentary work. And you're getting all this, but then you're getting the fun, like almost this hip hop element. And that's what gravitated me towards my style. Like, I'm going to be a fly on the wall. You're not going to hear me speak. You know, you're not going to, it's not about me. It's about the subjects. And intentionally, I winged certain moments that could have been very structured to get these authentic experiences where it wasn't diluted in me having a motive. So a lot of my stuff was like that. And I got that, you know, I was inspired by Sean Dunn for doing that.
One thing I noticed through the, when you were promoting it was that it definitely had a cinematic feel. The colors were very gritty. And you definitely did get the vibe of exactly what you said, like flying the wall, like someone in the room watching this. How much footage did you compile? I mean, and how much ended up making it? And did you check with people in the scene back and forth? Yeah.
So the craziest thing, JP, is another thing that was sourced for this was Nardwar. I was watching one of his TED Talks.
Oh, he's the greatest.
You know, he comes off, sometimes you hear something and it seems very basic, but if you don't do it, then it's not common sense and it's not basic. So I'm listening to Nardwar and he's talking about how he blew up, whatever. And he was like, look, nobody wanted to work with me, whatever. But I realized the power of asking and the power of hearing no to the point where you're used to hearing no, and it gets you closer to your yes. So long story short, he just asked. Certain artists, and they got back to him, or their reps got back to him and said yes. And he said that his reputation started to precede him, that since he had a catalog of these different interviews and they're very quirky, and the people saw that he was very, like, his research was on point, that it helped him build to the next big interview. And you know, I kind of see that as like pillars, you know.
Yeah,
try to teach people around me, and you know, something I'm going to teach my son, that you know, even if you can't see 5 or 10 years from now, you can look at what you're doing now as a pillar, you know. So example, like me, I want to put out an album before I die. I want to put out a book. I want to do different creative things, but sometimes I'm in the moment and I'm like, how is what I'm doing gonna build the foundation for my legacy, or when I die, how are they going to connect the dots to what I'm doing? And how's it going to kind of latch to this bigger picture of my legacy? You know, so kind of got that from hearing Nardwar, just in between the lines. So originally, I started with Florida stuff, but originally I had hit up Disaster and he got back to me. And I hit up Daylight, I hit up Saint, I hit up a few female artists, a few female battle rappers. And a lot of things were scheduling conflicts because I really wanted the female aspect to that too. They have a league called Queen of the Ring. So originally, I wanted to pitch this to Vice because I had a summer or two where I was in Miami and I was like, you know, I was teaching and I was like, look, I could really go ham in the summer. So originally I was going to pitch it to Vice. And when I was doing my research with Vice, I was realizing that their finder fees sucked. Like sometimes they'll get in a meeting with you. They'll be like, yeah, it's cool. and they would either not pay you or they would take your idea and run with it. And I was seeing what Vice was doing, and I was seeing what Noisy was doing, right? And I was like, man, I really want to do webisodes, because I'm a big fan of battle rap, but you would never get the like intricacies, you know, like the kind of like the HBO, you know, premiere, like before you see a Manny Pacquiao or Mayweather, yeah. You wouldn't get any of that fun storytelling. And I was like, why is it not there? And one of my first ideas, there's a battle rapper named Big K, and he used to be in prison, and he used to kind of fine tune his battle rapping skills in prison. And then when he got out, you know, he started cooking. He's one of my favorite battle rappers. So originally I was like, man, I want to figure out a way to get in the room and be able to go back to his old prison blog and see, you know, some of his homies that are getting out and how he kind of inspired them and all that. And I was like, but this is going to be one of those things where I need to build a rapport enough. You know, I'm not going to be able to do it now. I don't have a big enough platform. So that's why I was thinking Vice and all that. And then I just kind of polished it down. I scaled it down. And I was like, look, this is what I'm going to do. Nobody's really hitting the battle rap niche, and this is before Bodied. I had been working on this before Bodied. So I was like, this is what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna tap into the battle rap documentary culture so well that over time I'm gonna be able to do a something like that with Big K, and I'm gonna do what I can without the big corpse. And then at some point, if it makes sense, it'll make sense. Dumbfounded, I hit up Dumbfounded immediately in the beginning before he started cooking with Power and everything, and his management got back to me. And they're like, hey, sounds good. Can you send us something that you've done so we can get a little feel for your work? I had zero portfolio at the time.
Damn, so you were really asking
zero,
for it.
Zero, right? But then I started thinking of Nardwar, and I was like, bro, people really get back to you. Some people don't. Some people are snobby. I've had experiences where I'm like, yo, this guy, I know he started from nothing and now he's acting brand new, right? Certain people. But then I was like, damn, there's really people though that it's just all you got to do is ask.
Yeah.
So that was empowering. And what I started to do is my friend Vince, he had a webisode called Train of Thought, where the concept was to get aspiring creatives in their element during certain subway station runs and things like that, and get their story. So I would fly out every blue. I would have like these random vouchers, because if ever I went to California, if it's like an hour late, they give you like a $200 voucher. I don't know why, but Cali's always on it. So I had a couple vouchers, and I would fly out to New York certain like holiday weekends. I'll link up with Vince and we would get some stories. So long story short, I just build connections and stuff with my friends, and I build a strong enough portfolio that I felt good that if I reached out to somebody, I could show them some back catalog. But it ended up not working with Dumb, because every couple months when I would start to mold the documentary and send him things, he'd be like touring in New York, and then one time he was touring in Cali. We just kept missing each other. But his management was cool, and that was one of the first people that I reached out to. So it was empowering to know that all I had to do was ask. And there's the battle rapper in my documentary, Oops. He was a state rep, and I had the week off while I was teaching, and I was like, hey, you know, I want to come out. I'm doing a battle rap documentary. He was like, absolutely. I hit him up like maybe 4 days before I was going to go out there. He said, absolutely. I had a voucher. I think I got a flight for like 120, 160. Slept in a car in the rental for 1 day, and had some other fun experiences we can talk about later. But yeah, I got a story, man. I got a story, and all I did was ask.
That's so great.
Yeah.
So you get all the footage, you get Propel forward, you start editing it, you're almost finishing it. What's the process now? Because you have a finished product. How do you go on promoting it?
So the home stretch was taking it to film festivals. So I originally didn't know if I wanted to do film festivals. You know, at this point, my mentor was Sean Dunn, and I would listen to him, and he was just like, hey, you know, he just had his own experiences about staying independent and how film festivals, you know, you can do without them. But I didn't want to have that question of what if, and I thought it was strong enough. So I sent it to a couple film festivals. Ironically, I didn't send it to Miami film festivals.
Why not?
I knew the politics at Miami Film Festival with the film festivals in Miami because mm-hmm. I used to do a couple things down there, and I really thought it was strong enough, but it was one of those situations where I was like, I only wanted to send it to three. I was in the late deadline because early deadline's like spring. So I was already like in fall for some of the deadline because drops and I kept missing each other. Hold on. Hold on, JP. So drops and I kept missing each other and we finally hooked up in fall. But so late whenever you send something to a film festival and it's during the late registration, it gets a little higher. So I might have been in the like $80 or $100 range for some of them and maybe 60, but some of them start off as like, let's say 40. So at some point, the Miami Film Festival deadline was as high as sending it to like, let's say Sundance or South by Southwest. Wow. So I was like, man, for this, I'd rather send it to somewhere where it's going to be a little bit more, it's going to make sense, you know, like, so that's what kind of made my ultimate decision. But I still tried to find one or two film festivals that were kind of indie. So I think I picked one indie one, trying to think of the name. And then I think I picked Sundance and South by Southwest.
All right. So what was the result of that?
So I got back, I got the rejection letters, like sometimes February, March. I was like, bro, they just don't understand. There was a documentary that had the same guy, Bruce Franks, because we had interviewed him around the same time, and they were winning all these awards. It was called St. Louis Superman, winning all these awards. I'm trying to say Emmys, but it's not Emmys. What's the one with Parasite? I can't even think right now, man.
I'm not even sure.
But so it was winning all these awards, man. And then it was, because I want to say Oscars, because I'm such a music head, right? I can't even think. They're like, he lost his credibility. I'm like, I'm sleepy. It was winning all these awards, man. And what ended up happening, St. Louis ended up being nominated for like best short documentary. So I was like, man, I'm in the right place because I had interviewed the same guy, you know, I had interviewed Bruce Franks. Mm-hmm. So long story short, it was like four of them. It was one with like skateboarding, the Oscars. It was one with skateboarding and a few others. And it didn't win, but it was getting a lot of buzz. MTV ended up picking it up through the film festivals. And that's another cool thing. Like if you get enough recognition through a film festival, a network or like a big film production company may back it. Because what people do is like shorts are like the mixtape of films. So if you make a good 10-minute short and you're like, man, I did this with like $1,000 budget. They're like, dang, you know, a feature length is like an hour and 20. Mm-hmm. You know, if we give him 200K, imagine what he could do with what he did with 10 minutes, you know? So it's good like way to promote yourself. And it didn't win, but I saw it on MTV. I was excited about it. And I was like, man, like I had this Kanye moment. I was like, man, these people are that much better than me. Like, I just felt like my part of the documentary was way better for Bruce, way better. But then get that same recognition. And I know it's more of a networking thing, but yeah. So after that, I was like, you know, I didn't want to put on YouTube. I had it on Vimeo. And I didn't want to put on YouTube because I didn't want to have to deal with suing or things getting put down. And there were a few things that were more like documented paper trails through email. Some of them were like just like solid calls. Like, yeah, you can do that. But I just felt like YouTube might not have been the lane for it. And then I had dropped it a few times here and there and people were sleeping. So I was like, you know what? I need to outsource. So I made a poster for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sure I had enough cuts like for the, cause I had rounds in there, but I had been kind of lazy with my graphics. So I outsourced the graphics for like maybe $10 for all three graphic cards that I used on Fiverr. I like using Fiverr when I need to outsource.
That's great. I love Fiverr.
Yeah. So I outsourced on Fiverr for the poster and the rounds, and it just made a load of a difference. And I think I had a typo there that I changed. Felt comfortable doing it on YouTube. I downscaled the editing so that I didn't have any like copyright issues.
Yeah.
So I downscaled it and I put it on YouTube, sent it out to a few people that were part of the project. And I really only wanted 150 views, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's at 1,000. And I'm glad because I don't see something like this as something for recognition. Like, yeah, it would be cool if it gets 10,000. But what I really saw it was is something in my portfolio,
mm-hmm.
you know, something that's a pillar. So, you know, down the road when I die or if I need another gig or, you know, I'm rapping or I'm doing something, like that's cemented in stone. Like he created one of the first cinematic battle rap documentaries. He put Florida on. It's beautifully done. He could have had so many other things in it, but with what he did, it's perfect. And he's capable of doing that, you know? So that's how I see it. That's how I measure success. So it's at 1,000 right now, but I don't care. And I really only wanted 150 because, you know, what I think too is like the second thing you want to do as a creative, after you take that risk, you invest your 2K into something that you can bring it back, whether it's your music equipment, whether it's your photography equipment, whatever your hustle, clothing, trying to get 2K, right? 1,800 to 2K mm-hmm. and go all in, right? People can tell you, oh, you could take failures, but it's also the risk, you know, it's the risk you take, you know? So after the risk, I think the second thing is audience, right?
Sure.
Who's your audience? And to me, my number was 150 followers, 150. I feel like I could take over the world with 150 people. So I got to this number because at some point I did want music equipment. And another reason why I went to film first is because I knew I could make money off of film. You know, like my first year and a half, I made like maybe $850, maybe $900 off film. And it doesn't seem like a lot to people, but to me, it was cool because if you're making any kind of money, it's an investment, it's a flip, you know? And I knew starting off with music, it was going to be more of a passion thing and I was going to lose more.
Yeah.
And I knew that I wanted music to be something that I didn't have to worry about making money back. And I wanted to be in a great creative space to go back to the music, you know? So I didn't feel like I gave up, but I did feel like just the film made more sense. Like I could be passionate and I can get a little back in the income game. But yeah, I got to 150 because the next thing I wanted to do on my bucket list was write a book. So I've been playing around with some fiction stories, but the main thing I wanted to do was do a memoir because like my whole branding is about like just thinking in terms of opposites and almost like kind of putting my brand in this parallel universe where I do things that are very avant-garde, you know? And I always thought it'd be fun to do a memoir, you know, in my 20s for something that I would have said maybe in my 40s and 50s before my accolades are respected.
How would you make mm-hmm. a memoir for so young, so convincing though, since you haven't lived that long either?
That's a good question, man. I feel like I've been in my 40s and my 20s though, you know, like my 20s, and you could probably, you know, attest to this, right? Like mm-hmm. just how boring I was sometimes, right? Like, damn, Mick, have a drink, you know, or just little things. But my idea, and I've had this idea for a minute, is to write to like the letter of my unborn child, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to title it 2040, and at that age, I'd be 50, and it'd be things that I would want my son or my daughter to know going into their like 20 or 21 years of life, you know, but yeah. Hoping they'd still read it at around 13 or so, you know, sometimes what Jay says to me is biblical, and I'll never forget on New Day. He's like, you know, it took 26 years to find my path. My only job is cut the time in half.
Oh, man. You know? That's my favorite part of that tour.
Yeah. So I was like, I want to really give something to my children, because I feel like sometimes kids don't listen to parents, but they'll stumble upon things that are influential to them. So I wanted the memoir to act as this kind of clear headspace for creatives.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's certain things that I have to rewire in order to feel comfortable creating, right? Like sometimes it doesn't come naturally. Like you got to fight. You got to be like that Kanye in the room to fight for your like creative spirit. So I figured in 2040, I'd be able to do it. And as it was evolving, right? And I'm just saying memoir, but it's deeper. As it was evolving, I had, there was an artist in Miami that took his life. And I was like really close to him, like not like how like we're close, but just like how like you'd feel maybe really close to Metallica. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. like that kind of vibe. And it caught me off guard, because whenever I would see him, we would talk and stuff, but he was really living that like starving artist life, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes people embrace it, but then you really don't know how they're taking it, you know, because at the end of the day, we're artists, and sometimes you care about how you're being perceived or what you mean to the world a bit more than others, because you don't feel like you're a tool, you're in the matrix, you know?
Oh my God, he
took his life. And then
one
of my closest friends, you were liking some of the stuff that I had put up on Instagram the other day. My other close, like this guy I was really close to, like this was like, I would call him like my father, you know, but he was only like 2 years older than me, but he was like a father figure. He was like my OG. He took his life. And I was just thinking, man, I was just like, you know, I don't like going too deep into mental health sometimes, because I feel like some people try to capitalize off of it and make it like this whole like trend.
Yeah.
But I started to realize that as I was trying to build something for my unborn child, that I needed to give something to the world now that was very tangible, that was practical advice of how to move in the world, mm-hmm. as having as being a creative thinker. You know, that somebody is thinking outside the box, but feels boxed in. So that kind of just bridged everything for me, you know, and I felt like it was going to be like a meditation on living with a creative mind, you know? So that's why the memoir was easier, because it was supposed to be, it's supposed to be a mix of anecdotes, but also practical advice. And I guess just from my reading and my experiences, and 26, just you kind of finding your path, right? Let's say it was easy to give my son something, you know, mm-hmm. like that. Because I feel like sometimes memoirs come out when somebody's like 50 and they've seen it all.
Yeah.
But you're almost like, damn, what if they would have gave me game when they were 30 and I was 18, you know? Mm-hmm. So sometimes you can't wait, you know? And I think this is the whole theme of this week too, is like, sometimes you can't wait until you've experienced it all to be resourceful. You know, like that's kind of how they play artists too, right? Like an artist will sign you, and then when you're 35, they'll tell you how to sign other artists or how to get out of your little matrix trap. It's like, bro, you could have told me that before I signed you. You know,
the deals that Kanye was offering people versus the deals that he was getting, as I heard.
Exactly. So, you know, so thinking about the memoir, I was like, you know, if I can get 150 people to buy this book or to buy into this book, right? And I'm big also on like, you got to know things from an audience perspective, from a consumer perspective, and an entrepreneurial perspective, you know? So you got to know how much something's worth, right?
Yeah.
You also got to know what you're willing to pay for it, or how you're being played as an audience member, you know? So I was just like thinking, I was like, you know, obviously I'd probably try to triple my profit. Like if the book was $4, I might try to charge 14 or something. You know, other things I don't go that high. Other things I might just be like, I just want to break even. But I was like, this is going to be like my Kickstarter. Like if I can raise $800 to $900 with this book, I could put it into another kind of creative endeavor, like music, you know, like an album, you know, like I can use that for, you know, instruments or, you know, like beats or something like that. So kind of took it as a way to flip that and invest it into the next thing. And I feel like 150 just happened to be my mark with my, you know, with the total profit, you know, the net and, you know, what I would get back, the surplus, mm-hmm. you know, being around 800 to 900. So I was like, you know, I could do a lot with 150 people that just believe in me and feel like I'm giving them something, you know? And then if I triple that, you know, within 2 years to maybe 500, I'm good, you know, I'll stay with that 500. So that's how I've kind of seen, you know, my approach, you know, my first couple of baby steps was take risk and then find your audience, build, cultivate your audience.
How big of a risk are you willing to take though, to reach to the next step?
That's a good question, you know, and for everyone, it's different, you know, for everyone, it is different. I think the way to learn how to go to the next step, I'd say the third thing would be to cultivate wherever your energy is going.
Nice.
You know what I'm saying? So like mm-hmm. sometimes you'll see a buddy, right? And be like, well, I know this guy. This guy's a yoga teacher now. This guy's fake as fuck. He's a yoga teacher. This guy used to smoke blunts and sit on his couch every day. He's a yoga teacher. You know, but you may not know that at some point, maybe they were just doing yoga every day. They woke up, they were tapping in.
Yeah.
And they realized that all of their energy and time was going to seeing a better physical, you know, feeling better, you know, and you could say it's a trend, whatever, but maybe that risk they took, they opened up a yoga studio or whatever they did, they cultivated where their energy was going. And I think it's just like love. You can't determine who you love sometimes, you know, it's a gravitating, it's an unspoken thing. So I think to figure out what risk you're willing to take, it's an unspoken thing. You know, you see it all the time. There's a rapper, there's some artists and they're like, yo, I was doing nothing 2 years ago. And then it was just like this unspoken thing. It just, you know, was speaking to me and I gravitated towards it.
That's interesting. I think that people will sit sometimes between what they feel is risky and what they feel is enough to do. Cause risk could mean a lot to different people. Sometimes it's betting the house and sometimes it's just consistent small bets. So there's definitely ups and downs to it. Cause when I hear risk, I give up the house. I'm all about like, I don't care what it takes. So like, but as life gets older, that mentality for a lot of people tends to go away. Because you know, you have life and these other things, but at the same time, you're still dealing with that same creative itch that you've always had. And sometimes people don't listen to those flames and they just have to revel in it all the time. It just destroys them.
And sometimes risk is a positive thing too. Like, example, a buddy of mine, when I was first working on the documentary, he was trying to get rid of his PS4 to get a PS4 Pro, right? And he was like, hey, just give me $100 for this PS4, bro, because they're trying to play me at GameStop. And I was like, bro, no better feeling. And now, right, with the quarantine, I'm like, damn, bro, I'd love to play FIFA every blue or anything like that, right? But I turned it down because I knew it was going to take away half of my documentary time, you know? Mm-hmm. So even sometimes risk is also like, you know, do I want to sign to this major this year or wait 4 years?
Yeah, because what they offer you, that means your value is a lot more than what they're offering too.
Yeah, but it may look good, you know? And that's not to say, you know, everybody's situation is different. And I'm not trying to, everyone's situation is different. But I'm saying that like sometimes risk can be something that's given to you and there may be an unspoken responsibility or energy and time put into it. You know?
Yeah, man. I feel that that's a crucial development of it. what I think happens though is as with any person who has purpose and wants to do something, if you keep digging that ditch into conformity, like you're just digging a longer hole to get out of it.
Yeah.
And
that's a good point.
I haven't met a lot of people who aren't wanting to do stuff, but I have seen a lot of them allow life weigh them down. And however they want to allow that, but as you start seeing, as I did, as you get older, that kind of that negotiation starts to be a little bit more hazardous in our heads. Like you've been mentioning 26 is like an age that you've realized these things. And I'm pretty sure you wish you would have realized that shit at 21 so you can get more time. But I think artistically, that's just the shit we have to go through. Like I have to create, just like you got to create, no matter how I feel, how old I am, and however society dictates, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. But I feel like we cultivate things at different times, you know? Like, I think 26 just happened to be the right time. Like, I happened to get my money up, you know? You know, I was ready. You know, I'm very, like you said, I'm very in my head. I'm very calculated, but I'm impromptu, but I move when it's right. And it just seems to be the right. Like I don't really dwell on when. And I guess we'll get into that a little later. But I think it goes back to what we were talking about with having this ultrasound, right? When I was 21, coming out of college, I felt like I was in this. And I joke and I say, you know, they used to say that the midlife crisis was 33, 35. Now it's like 23.
Oh, you know? My God.
I feel like I was in this bubble where it was like I was supposed to conform and just be this like very vanilla, bland person at work and just not love anything I liked when I was younger because that's being an adult, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what I started to realize is as you get older, the things that kept you out of trouble or kept you curious or kept you loving life, that's kind of rooted to your passions. And there's got to be, you know, this thing that I'm kind of coining as your ultrasound, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's this sound in your head or it's this conscience where you're tapping into your youthful spirit. So no matter how older you get or any new hobbies you get, there's a kind of linear connection to your younger self, you know.
I feel like that's the way it has to happen. I feel like I am more invigorated to be artistic now than I was in all my 20s, because in all my 20s I was fighting every major battle except for that one.
I agree, man. I'm listening, man.
And now I have more freedom to do it because you spend all that your 20s and you kind of accumulate game, and now you realize that guess what, the game is not changing anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
All I can change is how I approach it, and there's plenty of success because I know age is the most
age is definitely mental, but there's so many ways to break that barrier
now. I think
talking about that today for sure.
I mean, like, go ahead. Like, I feel like what allowed me to break that barrier was getting older and realizing that, you know, I'm only racing against myself. So, like, what helped you?
So, what helped me was, for age purposes, was realizing that, like I said, the pillars, right? Just, I'd say the fourth thing is just the pillars, right? Like, instead of looking at it as 5 or 10 year goal, like, what can I do that's going to stand the test of time and that is going to almost be in my resume, you know, like just seeing it like that, you know? An example of what helped me with age is that I kind of developed this mission statement, you know, kind of developed this mission statement where I was reading Built to Last and I was reading a few other things and I was trying to see my creative aspirations is like a business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I hate when people used to tell me find a 5 or 10 year, 1 year goal. And I used to hate when people told me think of a mission statement. I thought that shit was corny as fuck. And then I heard Nipsey say it once. And to me, like my two top mentors, and you know, I've been saying it forever, even when people were hating on Nipsey, Nipsey and Socrates are like my two, like I'm their students, right? And he said it. And I was still like, this is corny. But I kind of bumped into Built to Last. I tried to go back into my routine when I was in college. And you can ask Wasser, he'll verify. I used to write 100 bars a day. I didn't leave unless it was going to class. I didn't leave until I wrote 100 bars a day. I would check Forbes Fastco, Brain Picking. Those are like my three websites.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where I got a song called Heavens for a G in 2010, and I shouted out Warby Parker. When would you say Warby Parker just blew up, JP?
Are you talking about like the glasses place?
Yeah, yeah, the glasses.
Why?
But I'm just saying, when would you say it blew up? Like maybe 2016?
I honestly have no idea. That's funny.
Okay, but I'm just saying that there's just this kind of vibe where like it wasn't a thing in 2010, but there's so many like kind of like these little niche resources that I would use. Every Blue, that was just early adopter shit. So I remember, yeah. I remember back then Forbes in 2010 was talking about Warby Parker. I was gonna like kind of disrupt the industry, and you know they probably sent their PRs out to kind of fix that, you know, and just kind of promote. They were talking about Khan Academy, which I still think is like crazy dope right now, and I forgot what the other one was, but I was just saying that like these are the things I was on like when I was in college. It was just like just kind of seeing where we're gonna go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like my routine. And the other, like 2018, I think it was, I kind of just went back to some of that, like kind of checking Forbes, kind of checking certain things I used to do, Brain Picking, checked Fastco. And they did this article on, and I, you know, I have the Pharrell one. I like Fastco. Mm-hmm. They had one on Janelle Monáe and how she was kind of trying to build her brand, build like her label and her brand, and some of the books that they were starting to do a brain trust with. And the three were Creativity Inc., Built to Last, and there was another one, but I think I had already read it, so I didn't write it down. So I started reading Built to Last, immediately purchased Built to Last, Creativity Inc. Creativity Inc. is one of my favorite books of all time right now. And I'm reading Built to Last, and they said the same thing about the mission statement. So at this point, JP, I'm pissed, right?
Why?
I'm like, bro, if I hear another person say it, tell you not, man, 2 weeks during winter break, 2 weeks. So this might have been 2017. 2 weeks, bro. I'm really thinking about this, right? Really, I'm like, all right, fuck it. I'm gonna do this mission statement thing. You're right. Just thinking. And it came to me, man. It came to me, and it was my mission statement is to make others feel more comfortable in their own skin.
Oh, okay.
That was my mission statement. And regardless of age, me standing behind my mission statement has given me a foundation that when I built these random pillars up,
mm-hmm.
I don't see age. Okay. I don't see age. So example, right? Like when I did the 30 documentary, I had that foundation of like, just making battle rappers. Cause sometimes people are like, why do you do this? Why do you go out? You know, like I kind of gave them a cool why, like this is why, you know,
mm-hmm.
I had a bunch of scripts. I forgot to tell you this too. I have been writing a bunch. I have so many scripts. I have so many like film ideas, book ideas. I had this script idea that I kind of scrapped, and I brought it back once those two people passed that I talked about earlier, that I had this idea called Nine, where, the main character has nine lives, and nine lives in a sense that he has nine near death experiences, kind of like a cat, you know, cat has nine lives.
Mm-hmm.
And just really built on it, but I had scrapped it because I didn't know it's why, and I didn't want it to be cliche because mental health started getting popping again. And I wrote this when I was like 23, and then once the two buddies died, I was like, man, what would have happened if I would have put this out in the world, you know, and really gave it a proper script and filmed it, gave it a proper 10-minute short, tried to shop it around, maybe see it on Netflix. I'm like, mm-hmm. this might have helped somebody get out of their anxiety of like death and suicide, you know?
Yeah.
So just back on that mission statement, I was like, I got to pick this back up because this is going to make other people feel more comfortable in their own skin. And I had been thinking about it this week, right? Because I know you a lot. And I was like, JP, what would JP's mission statement be? And I'm like, regardless of what medium JP's in, JP's mission statement is attack your fears. you may have something different, but I'm saying from my point of view, right? Mm-hmm. When I hear Nitro Boys, or I hear a couple joints that I tell you like, yo, that's my favorite, the call and response, the way you're calling the action for the audience, I feel like whenever I'm with you, you give me, even if I'm very confident and the fear you bring up is like minimal, it's like 2% for me, but I know it's 60% for someone else. It's like this constant attack your fears, you know, do what makes you uncomfortable. Don't regret that shit, you know? So that mission statement really, really helped to gauge the age thing. And another thing that helps me with the age thing is with my branding, I've always tried to be like this time traveler, like this kind of parallel universe troll, you know? So I have so many things I've written in my 20s, music-wise, script-wise, et cetera. And I've always told my friends this, you know, like now that I'm hitting 30, right? It's like, and this is another thing. I would say this is like kind of like business model, right? I put this as the step two, like step 10 will be like your business model, right? I used to always read whatever my favorites would read. So I've read a bunch of books Jay's read, a bunch of books Pac read, a bunch of books that Nipsey read. And one of Nipsey's books that he would praise was Purple Cow. You can find it online and stuff. It's like 50 pages. And in Purple Cow, they talk about the unconventional, right? And why the unconventional wins in certain situations, right? Like they had this example of this bar that was word of mouth. Like it just said, shh. And the only way you knew about it is if somebody told you about it. Mm-hmm. And it was like back in the day, like let's say 60s or the 20s or something. It wasn't like in this current market. And it got so popping, so packed that they had to change it to like another place and it kind of died. But it was just going off of how like marketing sometimes it's not supposed to make sense.
Yeah.
And how like you're supposed to be unconventional and you can get the most out of that. And just through things like Purple Cow and just the way my mind's wired, right? I started to think about audience, right? This has nothing to do with Purple Cow. This is just like my epiphanies, but I'm just giving you like what helped me get to these epiphanies. Mm-hmm. I started to think that your audience, right? You can't see things from a music perspective right now. You got to see it from an audience perspective. You only have two kinds of audience members. You really have three, right? Like, you know, mainstream hip hop, you have like your people that are in the matrix. They just get spoon fed, whatever the label gives them, right? Mm-hmm. Like whatever's popping on the radio. And then you have like your underground, right? So if you think of it like in this current age, right? You only have two audience members. You have an audience that has heard everything in your back catalog and they're like, man, this person's so slept on, they're underrated, and they go to war for you. Like they know all your shit. They're trying to, they're like almost like trying to be like the messenger, you know, like how Jesus had his descendants because people were sleeping on Jesus. You know, I told you he was a chosen one. So you have like this audience that'll ride for you because you have so much quality that they want to be like, I'm the early adopter. I was here when everybody slept on you.
Yeah.
You know? And then you have this other kind of audience that you may only have a hit or two, but they want to be the early adopters. They want to say, I saw it when nobody was coming, right? Like mm-hmm. your weekend. Like we were all on board when we heard in the morning, right? Yeah. So you have these two audience members. And when I was in my 20s, I was telling my buddies, I was like, look, because my buddies were kind of self-conscious because they had like three or four dope albums, but not everything was hitting, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, look, bro, you got to attend to one of these audience members. You either, based on what they were telling me, I was like, you either wipe all your shit, we do one or two dope-ass singles. People think that you just started rapping yesterday. This mm-hmm. is something you can do in your early 20s, right? Or early in your teens. And I was like, we spend whatever budget we got to spend on a dope-ass single, and we milk the album release, kind of like what Rory did, you know?
Yeah, still a good plan today,
right? Exactly. And then this is my plan, right? Like I'm 30 now, right? So this is why I don't care about age. I have so much music stuff, but I never had like the equipment that I needed because I had banked on film. That I'm like, look, if you're my age and you're feeling like it's not cool to be 32 or 30 or 29 or 28 and drop that new, you know, like, but Griselda's done it, right? And another thing, going back to what you're saying, that people get in their 30s. I just, 8 of my favorite albums right now are from people that, especially in rap, that just turned 40.
Mm.
I just heard Lecrae's shit. I've always felt like he's been like hit or miss. His best project, 40. A$AP Rock, Impossible Kid, at least from a flow perspective, I think he might get better with beat selection and kind of, you know, 40. When he did Impossible Kid, you know, you look at the Griseldas and stuff, they're getting up there. You know, you look at the J, you know, Magnum Carter, you know, you look at certain things, it's like, we're in a streaming era, bro. So my marketing plan is going to be drop a lot of shit and just, because I have timestamps for the most part, like when I wrote it, whatever, like, bro, oh, I dropped this when I was 24. I dropped this 2014. First off, right now, nobody's going to care enough. And then at some point, I'm just going to build that catalog. So then people are going to be like, damn, but they've been sleeping on retro. You know what I'm saying? So like, you have that power, man. You have that power to, if you had some cool EPs, you know, in 2013 and you want to put it out, you could put it on streaming. Oh, this came out October 2013, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody's going to check that shit. You know what I'm saying? And get to the point where you're building a catalog, you know, because when we were in 20s, we wanted everyone to be the one, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
We wanted to just have 3 albums and be like, you know, if I would have had a 3 album deal, it was a 3 and out. But when you're older, you can kind of play with your catalog to the point where if you drop something new, people have a back catalog to go to, enough content that like, they're just, oh, this is my favorite artist. They got a couple, you know, records they can go to.
True.
You know, especially with streaming, it works, you know? So I have a bunch of things in my 20s that I just want to kind of record, get out there, timestamp it 2016, 2018, 2014, 2013, 2012. And, you know, if I get to the chance where I drop my magnum opus at 32 or 36, it's fine because I'm still giving the audience the where I came from. And it's going to be polished because I'm still recording it.
Do you feel like you still have the same vigor for making new material?
That's a good question. I feel like I'm more conscious of what I'm saying. I don't feel like my form and function is where it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like what I'm saying or the energy, the vibrations I get, the source material that I revisit now that I'm older is timeless, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of the things I listen to now are timeless. Like what's in my rotation right now is Jamila Woods' Legacy. I think that's the best album of the last decade. And Who Told You to Think by Milo. He dropped that young, though. He was a young buck. He was like 25 when he dropped that.
Oh, shit.
But yeah, so those are two that I always go back to. I've been getting back into Christian hip hop a little bit.
Oh, okay.
And just seeing that, like, as they've gotten older, they've broken their barriers of feeling like they only need to cite a biblical scripture every other bar, you know? Like, I'm hearing their stuff, and I'm like, bro, they're vulnerable. They're saying things that are not mainstream, and they're saying things that, like, I would hear from a Kendrick or something, and they're able to kind of polish that. I'm God-fearing, and I'm a God person, but, you know, friends are shady sometimes, or... You know, sometimes I just want to sit on my boat and chill or smoke a stogie. You know, like they're more relatable. I feel like the Christian hip hop community is more relatable right now. And I've always been a fan, but I've been using that for a lot of source material because it feels like grown folks music, but it's also got this nostalgia to it.
Yeah.
So that's what I kind of report back to, you know, and it's different from a hip hop perspective because if you have an ear, if you don't pick any trap heavy shit, you can find things that are timeless. But in your field, it's a little different because I feel like in other genres, you're playing more with like colors. You're playing more with like big sound versus low sound, you know, like. You know, like we said, just trying to find that ultrasound.
Yeah, man. Color and textures. Like an error.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's the name of the game for me. Colors and textures. More important thing.
But yeah, man, I know I've been talking a lot. I want to tell you, like, based on what we're saying, man, like, based on some of the things we're talking about, what do you think about that? Like, how do you think that might help you or us moving along?
What specifically?
Just like... not worrying too much about age right now, kind of developing a mission statement, what are going to be some of your like risk moving forward, or where you see you putting your energy, even sonically too? Because that's what I noticed too. When my main thing with rapping is like, I was still like, I had an innate ability to rap like fucking Nas or AZ, but I would gravitate because I could do it in like 5 minutes. I can make a big Sean or Drake record in like 2 minutes. So I was dealing with this like hip hop dilemma, you know? Mm-hmm. But now the music I gravitate towards is the music I want to make, you know? So like, I guess I would ask you music wise, what energy, like what are you driven towards more sonically, and how is that impacting your creative space?
I've always
not even music, because I know you're big on clothes and stuff, and I was gonna bring that up too. Like, you know, if you think about the risk thing, right? Like Drake wanted to do merch from the get. Everybody was like, "Yo, I'm ready for this OVO sweater. Let's get it." Well, he didn't drop merch until Nothing Was the Same, and he was intent about that shit. And I know you've seen a bunch of interviews. He would only give it to his buddies, and he didn't make merch a thing until album 3. Dog, he was focused on the music. You know, so I think a lot of people, you don't realize how many people really do what I'm talking about, where like they don't invest in that next risk until they're able to put enough full-time energy into that next thing.
It depends on how you're looking to scale. You know, in my process right now, I finished music research. There's music done. There's now music that has to be finally finished. Which, and then in the background, I have to start thinking about the visuals to accompany the music. It just becomes for me, becomes like a sprint, basically. Yeah. And there are just some parts that are more fun than others, and some things just need to get done. And right now, I'm more in the anxiety of wanting to do work, not necessarily in the creative part. Like, I think I already did my research. I've done my thought process already. So I just kind of want to get the product out. And like, I have this, like, it's like an itch to finish it. So I can like hear it in a year and hate it and then figure out how to get better.
I get you.
I'm in the thick of it. Like, I am so in the thick of it. So it's just like, ugh. Like I know what I want things to look like. Mm-hmm. At least I have that, but I'm in the thick of it. So it's like, kicking my ass to start doing everything after the year it's been. And just more focus and more lining up. The same thing with the podcast, which is something I enjoyed, but I fell out of just because of the COVID stuff. So reaching out to more people, having better conversations, because that keeps me fueled up too. So it's a mixture of a lot of things. And it's like you said about your, your brand. Just figuring out how to do that. Ultimately, I want my brand to be like, I could just do whatever the fuck I want all the time. So as long as I'm moving towards that direction, I'm pretty good. The thing is now, like, looking up how to make money off everything, right? How to make more money off podcasting, how to make YouTube money, a little bit in every pot.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at too, where I'm just like, you know, I got to create an LLC at some point, and I got to like just kind of fine tune things that way and talking to people about it, you know, talking more with you and some of my buddies about just legitimizing things, you know, like, you know, hey, might do streaming again, you know, what should I use, DistroKid or this, you know, TuneCore, or, you know, I want to make an LLC, but, you know, I want to get my papers right, you know, should, you know, what registry agent do you use, or, you know, what website was the smoothest for you, you know, like little things that I already know who to talk to, but I just haven't had a chance to, like, I'm not there yet because I'm still trying to work out the creative things. Like, I'm the type of person that I'll do a bunch of research. Like, before I even wrote one book, I was doing research on how to self-publish. And then I went back into writing the book. And then I'm like, okay, I'm not going to full out LLC and do this until I have some finished products, you know, which I'm almost done with. But yeah, I get you. Now it's about the monetizing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, not to the extent, I think you have to think, you know, snowball effect. Like, if you get one sponsor, you can get more. Just like you said, the power of asking.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you have 3 or 4 different avenues you can do that, you can quit your day job quicker.
Yeah.
Or not even have to, or just take a smaller workload in different places and live a more balanced life with more things to do.
Yeah, man, I agree. And, you know, Nipsey was big on that. You know, when I used to look at his interviews and stuff, he was like, the best way to create is to have three sources of income. So you're not solely striving off of making money off of the thing that you create, you know, and that not everybody can get, you know, get to that point, but that was inspiring to hear, you know, like to try to have these different avenues where like, so when you tap in, it's not about it. It's about how fun that shit sounds when you crank it in your car, you know, or how it makes you feel when you have the top back, you know, you listen to your own stuff.
Every element of it, I mean, for me, it's just laborious. I know other people describe it. I'm like, well, the fun part is in between the labor. It's the hearing it the way you want it to sound like for the first time, or stacking these ideas in the way you want. Like, that's the fun part for me. But, you know, for a 4-minute song, like, the majority of people don't know what it takes to get into that. Mm-hmm. So it becomes like, yeah, I'm going to stress about that on myself. But like if you get too close to me, you get that information. But the podcast is to reveal that. So it is fucking tough. And I know why people don't do it. And I know why people only do like one or a couple things. But at this point, I would have it no other way. Like, what's the alternative? You know, I might as well just gun for it. And the same thing that you said, I was speaking about legacy in my prior episodes. Because legacy to me is really important. And it's even more important now because of the lasting effects I think I've realized that my words have and I have towards everybody. So there's more graduated purpose towards everything we do now. So we have to accomplish those things, because how are you gonna teach your kids to do something if you've never done it? A lot of parents, I feel like, operate on like, oh, you shouldn't do this. I'm like, it ain't worked for me growing up. I mean, I know you headed the more conservative direction. I didn't. You know, once I got out of my oversecure house that I basically had to live on, like, on eggshells, I just busted the fuck out. So,
I lived on eggshells too, man. So I know exactly what you're saying.
So, I mean, everybody comes to different results and shit. But the one thing I wanted to do is, hey, how are you going to establish a relationship if you can't accept the truth? Right. Cause, you know, I think even right now, not right now, but on IG, just seeing like, you can't have your kid come and tell you the truth if they're going to be mad at you for saying it. And it only takes one time for you to be mad. Think about that as a parent. One time for you to overload, for them to never trust you. It's a hard game to be in.
Yeah.
But the legacy stuff then flips, because if you are successful in what you do and you can live off that, or you can provide off that, it's an easy example to say. You'd be like, you can do this. Ideas aren't far-fetched if they're from somebody you know how to do, which I had a filmographer on the pod. By the time this episode comes out, that one will be out. And he was just like, I went from, you know, making no money to asking for 6 racks of production at least, and having this and this and this. So the power of asking is huge, but the power of belief is even bigger. And then the power of a legacy combined to all that just make you into a fine chiseled machine that, I guess, like me, wakes up at 6 a.m. no matter what happens, because I got to get shit done. Like, it's not even fun anymore. It's not even, there's no feeling anymore to it. It's just like, I got to do shit. Like, dude, totally feel you on that one. It's been the topic of everybody's mind as I've been talking to more people. Of like how 2020 treated you, or it could remove the family member, remove your job, it could remove the whole bunch of things from you. You know,
my 2020 was different though, because I would always wake up 4 a.m., 3 a.m., 2:30 a.m., work out, eat clean. Like, I was a machine in my 20s, and this year was one of the few years. I've had 3 years in my life that I was just living like in a very fun, like almost Truman Show manner. It was 2000, a little bit of 2010, 2011, 2018, like the like half year of that, and 2020. You know, and my quarantine was a little different, because I started to like and I was 29. So I started to be like, bro, my 20s has always been like living in my 30s. Like, I just want to live in my 20s a bit. So 29 felt like college to me in the sense that, like, I woke up whatever time. I didn't worry about what I ate. You know, it was like an evolution. It was like a circle where I tried to, like, just embrace being a nobody and embrace, like, relaxing for a little, because I knew that once the quarantine left, we were going to miss it. And I think it was teaching us things about, like, some of the things we've been talking about, were like legacy or what's really important. Like, is a 9-to-5 really important? Obviously, you know, to get bread, the capitalist society, like, really to provide for yourself, to move, the mobility. But, you know, it just kind of made me appreciate just being in a room of one's own space and, like, cultivating my feelings and spending time with myself.
Yeah.
You know? So that was great. That was great as far as the quarantine went. It made me, like, kind of chill out, but it didn't happen naturally. Like, it's something I'm bragging about now, but it didn't. Like, I was like, oh man, you know, we're going to be quarantined. Got to make this. Got to do my bucket list now. And then just something just made me just stop and just be like, nah, man, this is not what it's about. It's about, you know, hugging your wife and calling your buddies, making sure they're okay, you know, being kind, you know, listening to yourself, you know. And I gained some weight for it, but it just makes my bucket list look that better. Now when I look at six pack, I'm like, all right, there's still something I gotta attack. So I just see it as something fun, like just another challenge. And I think that's what, like, as you get older, that's what it is. It's like, what can you still have fun doing? That's how I kind of see it. What can you still have fun doing? So if you're getting out of shape, you can still have fun getting in shape. Mm-hmm. That's something that life's always going to give you an opportunity to do. You can never be in, like, perfect shape, you know, unless you're still getting paid millions to, like, you know, dunk and, you know, throw football.
Yeah, you know? I understand that one as I'm trying to get into better shape for health. But, mm-hmm. Hey, man, it is what it is in reference to just, like, as we're getting older, just the things we have to achieve change, or the orders change, I guess, you know? Mm-hmm. But on that note, I think we spoke a bunch. Any closing remarks? I'm pretty content. I learned a lot about you in this conversation. But if you want to plug anything, let anybody know anything before we head out. Definitely, I want a part two next time, for sure.
So this has been weighing on me.
Go ahead.
In 2013, I was not as creative as I wanted to be. And I always appreciated that I had a kind of hub to hang out with you and just feel like I wasn't having the pressures of adapting to the office and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still working on mixing and stuff, and I'm trying to get this cable at some point for my preamp, but I'd like to revisit 2013. I want to do a punk tape, very inspired by Holt and a few other things I've been kind of listening to, and Fantastic Negrito, other shit. But I'd like to collab with you on a project I want to call Punk Tape. And I don't know when I'm going to really lock down on it, but I'd like to have a feature with you. I'd like to lock in and do a couple songs with you for Punk Tape.
I'm super about it. any creative muscle flex, and you did help us back in the day a lot. So mm-hmm. there's no reason not to extend that and get something cool going.
I'm excited. Like, I'm really excited. I'm really a chameleon when it comes to music.
Mm-hmm.
I'm known to be, like, more of a hip hop head, but I'm very, like, very chameleon like. So I'm looking forward to some call and response with JP and just some different shit.
All right, man.
Serious, man.
No, I'm super down to do it.
Fucking dead serious. Like, I'm dead serious, man. Like, even with the mic shit, I'm not even really worried about I'm just like, yo, who can I lock in? Who's always been a dream feature for me, but I've just been kind of like not ready, you know?
Mm-hmm. Dude, we'll do it. But anyways, I think we're good on this podcast. I want to thank you for being on it. I want to thank you for being super cooperative and making the time. And is there anything you want to plug in? Like, do you want to see where we can last find your thing, stuff?
Retro 1920. My aspiring, like, you know, brand or company name would be EST1920. My kind of pitch would be Grow Beyond. Kind of was inspired by the Yoda conversation that he had in 7 and 8. You know, like the burden of the master is that our students grow beyond what we teach them.
Mm-hmm.
And my mission statement is to make others feel more comfortable in their own skin. And I'd say just rewire, unlearn, see the world differently. Think in terms of opposite, something I'm really going to bring up in 2040. So I hope you guys have a chance to read. And what I just wrote down for today was, you know, number one, take risk. Try to have about 1800 on you to 2K. Take a risk. Think more in terms of risks than failures. What risk can you take?
Mm-hmm.
Try to build an audience. You name your number. I'd say 150. Cultivate your energy. Cultivate whatever you're giving the most time to, like a parent would, like your favorite parent or your favorite family member did for you.
Mm-hmm.
Grow pillars. Number four is grow a pillar. Think in terms of whatever you do is a pillar. How's your reputation going to precede you and be on your resume? Once you kind of develop those four, try to develop a room of one's own and really think intimately about how that room is going to look. Think of space in terms of negative space, like a painting. The more negative space a painting has, the better you're going to be as a person, as a thinker. So, you know, sometimes if you're feeling lonely, you can enclose your room. Certain things in your room you can enclose so you feel more warm. If you're feeling claustrophobic, air out your room, minimize it. So there's little tricks like that where you think of terms of opposites that'll help you even just with your daily life. Like you said, sometimes your mental food, that's also something like a sight thing that helps you. Six is your mission statement. Find your mission statement. Treat your moves like a business. Seven, cross-platform marketing. Once you have your mission statement, you can, like JP is doing, you can cross over to podcasts, you can cross over to music, you can cross over to book deals, because there's a certain integrity, there's a certain backbone, there's a certain value you have, certain kind of business model or brand or thing you're giving to the audience that they know. Mm-hmm. That's pure, it's authentic. Next, after that, once you build those seven, try to take risk, try to find some other sources of income, some assets that you can use to, you know, just grow your wealth. And then, nine is branding. Once you get there, really brand. I always, every now and then I go back to what Kanye did for Donda and just seeing his bigger departmentalized game plan of like, even down to like clothes to, nonprofits to film to amusement parks. Like every month I lock in and I look at that Donda.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm talking about, that black and white brain map, I go back and look at it, and that's how you got to see branding. 10, develop a kind of business model. That's what we were talking about when I talked about the audience. You either have an audience that wants to be an early adopter and say, oh, y'all niggas sleep, like how I do with the Miami Heat on Instagram, or you have your audience where they want to be the first one. You know, I want to be the first one to say that, you know, I tried this year MSM7B, or I was the first one, you know, I have the first Demigod limited print. So work on that. When you think of audience, try to cater to one of the two at the same time or at opposite times. Business model, that was a business model. 11, outsourcing. Once you get to the point, you can outsource, you know. Or brain trust, which is talked about a lot in Creativity Inc. Just outsourcing if you can't do it. I use outsourcing as a last resort, but once you start picking up different things, it's okay to outsource. Just do it in a way that makes sense to you, that's still authentic to your audience. You know, like you might not want to outsource your rhymes.
Yeah,
You
true.
may
No
not want a
ghostwriters.
ghostwriter, you know, but maybe if you're used to, like, J. Cole's outsourcing a bit now, right? He's like, he's trusting more people with beats so he could focus more on the rhymes. So just knowing when to outsource is important. Like, I did everything for the documentary, but I got lazy with the graphics and I learned it in school, and I don't want to spend 8 months trying to fine tune graphics because I'm very idiosyncratic. I outsourced it on Fiverr. And sometimes you think you can't do something because you haven't outsourced yet. Like, I didn't think I could write a book until I drew a cover of the book. So if you're like that, where everything's got to kind of click at the same time, figure out a way to outsource. You got Fiverr. You got things like, I put it here. It's a, you have mastering outsourcings that's free now. Have you checked any of that, JP?
I don't dive into that. I don't. That's not part of my job description. I don't fuck with that shit.
I get you, but I'm just saying for maybe kids that are like 14, 15.
No, I wouldn't. To be honest, I wouldn't even know because.
Yeah, so there's a website like Lander and BandLab that you can just upload, and it'll kind of like gain or kind of raise radio friendly to a radio friendly extent, depending on what kind of platform you're using. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was just giving that as an example as a form of outsourcing. I know you have an amazing team, you know. I was just saying for some people, like some of my friends don't outsource their album covers or any illustrations because they got fucking like these artists meccas, you know, that they've been tight with, you know, robbing liquor stores and, you know,
I mean,
hanging out with, you know, they have like, they just have like their guys are their guys, you know. But if you don't have that, you know, definitely outsource. And my last one, because I know I'm talking to death, I was just going to say that a lot of things are like very traditional biblical,
mm-hmm.
Where like the market is law in that sense, but finding a way to disrupt the market a bit, right? So like, I've been watching football today before we started talking, and I was like, hey, in football, you have rules, right? You have flags. If you do certain things, you can get in trouble. There's rules and regulations, but there's always every now and then that you have a, you know, you have a Mahomes, or in basketball, you have a Steph Curry.
Mm-hmm.
You forget about the rules and the regulations, and that creativity really sparks, and you see somebody play the game like you've never seen before, and it's inspiring. So those are kind of like my 12 steps. It's very different from what I have in my book, but it was just 12 things I was really thinking about intently before we started today.
I can't say enough. Thank you, man. You've been a great guest. And thanks to anybody who listened. Thank you for listening to the podcast. And we'll talk to y'all soon. Thank you. Awesome, dude.
For talking so much, JP. I was excited to talk, man.
No, that's fine. And I could stop the recording.